for vaccination, we reach him even if we are not totally safe, as there is no place which is safe at Gaza.
For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Elmighari in Gaza.
I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Afternoon, Maryland, Virginia, D.C., wherever you are tuned in, you're listening to Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. My name is Daniel Del Pielago, and you're listening to Taking Action. Before we start out, I just want to make sure that I thank everyone who contributed to this show during our recent drive and in general that contributed to keep WPFW going. We are honored. We are thankful. And we couldn't do it without y'all. So thank you so much for your continued support, your new support for those new donors, new listeners. We really do appreciate it. I am honored to have this afternoon. I am joined by Vic, Evan, and Faye, who are going to be talking to us about a very serious issue. Recently, this past year, there were some actions to bring attention to what's happening in Palestine, the people that are dying, and some demonstrations here in the district. Unfortunately, there was some terrible police reaction to these actions. So we are going to be discussing that. And in general, what this means for people using their voices, people using the right they have to uplift concerns they have with what's going on, not only here in the district, but within the world. So I want to welcome Faye, Vic, and Evan for joining us this afternoon. Welcome to the show, y'all.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
No problem at all. And before we get started, I just want you all to introduce yourself, you know, share a little bit about yourself, whatever you'd like to share, so folks know a little bit about who they'll be listening to this afternoon.
Sure. I'm Vic. I am an organizer in DC, been involved mostly in the housing justice space, but have been involved in pro-Palestine direct action organizing since October. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much, Vic. Faye?
Hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for having us again. My name is Faye, and I work with the Good Trouble Cooperative out of Ward 1, Greater Columbia Heights area in DC. We're a mutual aid organization dedicated to redistributing resources across Ward 1, but also across Greater DC. And we see the violence in Palestine as only an extension of the violence that the United States imposes not only on its own citizens, but on the rest of the world every single day. And so the fight for Palestine is the fight for all of us. Thank you so much for having us today.
Thank you. Evan?
Yeah, hello. Thank you again. I want to echo what Faye was saying about this fight and the continuation of violence that we see domestically and abroad here, and the war on Black and Brown bodies, particularly in this case, most predominantly, and is the reason why we're protesting Palestinians. So I am actually not from DC, but I've been working for Palestinian liberation for years, particularly in the capacity as a Jewish person and kind of building out the flank of anti-Zionist Jewish community. And when the October 7th attacks happened, I you know, had just moved to DC and kind of arguably perhaps blew up my life and began throwing down with If Not Now to organize on the ground, the Jewish community, build out the resistance on the ground in DC with partnerships of people, and found myself getting rooted and becoming involved in the local organizing that had been happening there for decades and decades and decades. And that's part of what brought me to the protests at the DNC, which I'm sure we'll be talking about more soon.
That's right. No, thank you for teeing that up.
Of course.
My next question, and you know, this is open to if everyone would just kind of talk about it. So as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this past November, there was a candlelight vigil in front of the DNC, the Democratic National, what is that? What does the C stand for?
Committee. Democratic.
There we go. Thank you for educating me. I always just say DNC and don't really know the whole acronym. Anyway, you along with hundreds of other folks were there that day to, you know, protest, to bring almost literal light. It was a vigil for all those who have died in Palestine. So take us back to that day. You know, what was going on that day?
Yeah, I'm happy to chat a little bit about some of the love and care that went into the event that ended so brutally. And so some of the planning that went into this event was the idea that by this point we had only known of around 11,000 people who had been martyred in Gaza. And so at this time period, the number was 10,000 people, right? And so for us, what we decided to build and create was a different world where we understand that every single one of those lives meant something, that they were a part of a community, part of a family, part of a social fabric that loved them and needed them. And every single life that was lost was a light. And so we orchestrated this action so that we could really show the world that these are the lights being put out. And they're being put out with the funding from our government, Democrats and Republicans alike, who are both funding this genocide, who are funding Benjamin Netanyahu's genocidal rage against the Palestinian people and his efforts to wipe them out. And so now you fast forward to today, and now we know that there are over 100,000 people who have been murdered. More, really, if you count the people who are missing underneath the rubble, the people who are dying from disease and famine. The numbers keep growing. The Democratic Party has continued to choose apathy, has continued to choose violence, has continued to choose corporate profit over the desires of the American people. That was our message in November, and that's our message now. That's why we were outside of the Democratic National Committee holding an action specifically to bring light, right? Imagine such a terrible violence accosting of people because of their attempt to bring some light to an institution that has only shown darkness within recent months. And so I just wanted to put a little bit of that framing of the actual action was the laying down of candles, was the holding up of lights. That was the action. And it was always about life. It was always only about love for people. And what we've been shown time and time again is that the state is willing to retain power at pretty much any cost, even if that cost is its own people. And even though these are the people who we elect, these are the people who, if we're talking about the police, we pay for with our tax dollars. These are the people who are supposed to be serving us. These are supposed to be public servants. But at the same time, we know that corporate interests are what reign.
Yeah.
Thank you for that framing, Faye. Vic, Evan, anything to add?
I would just add that, you know, we're going into 11 months of this genocide, and the action that we're talking about happened in November. That was, you know, like Faye was saying, that was 10,000 lives, 10,000 people who had been martyred at that time. And in November of last year, no Democrats were calling for a ceasefire. At that point, you know, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Nancy Pelosi, no top Democrat, much less Joe Biden, had called for even a ceasefire, had called for the, no one had called for, you know, the bombs to stop dropping. And that's why we were at the Democratic National Committee, because they are the party in power. And, you know, they all had put out statements about, you know, our condolences to Israel for October 7th, and had not said anything about the thousands of martyrs in Palestine. And we know since then that they have continued to send billions and billions of dollars in bombs, ammunitions to Israel to continue this genocide.
Thank you, Vic. Evan, I want to make sure if you have anything to add.
No, absolutely. That's 100% correct. This was an action where as Faye was saying, we brought, I believe we weren't even able to physically carry, because we had glued over 10,000 little tea light candles to cloth to bring them as a visual representation of all of the thousands of lives who at that point had been killed in this affront, in this genocide, in this collective mass punishment and siege in Gaza. And it was really disheartening that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, met us with such violence, as I'm sure we'll get into now. And you know, this, I know this is a radio medium, but I would encourage listeners to go and just search for some of the images that came up of that, you know, that night, the next morning, with the police stomping on all of these candles, just them leaning the streets. And, you know, I was one of the people whose glasses were bashed off my face by the cops attack. So I had to go back with a friend that next morning and try to recover some lost items, including my glasses, to no avail. And just seeing all of these candles stomped out in the streets and everything else at the scene pretty sanitized was really disheartening. And I feel like that is, regrettably, has been the response of the DNC and the Democrats. And it's just, you know, hearing these numbers of the official death count, and we know it was more then, we know it's more now, being, I think it was 11,000 back then in November, and now it's over 40,000. And just, you know, the message that we were bringing to their doorstep, right? Because these were not people, even though in their capacity as elected officials, who should be receptive to us. We had to go to them during their really big fancy meal, where they were recruiting other people to run, kind of patting themselves on the back. So we were lining the streets there. And the setup for the action was, we were bringing these candles, we were having this vigil, we were leading each other in interfaith prayer. We were singing and chanting, ceasefire now, stop the violence, calling for peace, right? Really reviving the anti-war movement. It was in peace. It was in that love that Faye and Vic were talking about. And it was met with such unprecedented violence towards this kind of demonstration in DC. And, you know, it's just the lingering thought on my brain right now is just, boy, if they had listened, right? What the death toll is then, what it is now, these people with all this power, if they had been able to hear us and not just have the cops brutalize and remove us so they could get back to their limousines.
Thank you for that, Evan. Yeah. So, like, yeah, let's definitely get into what happened as a result, right? You all, as has been mentioned by the three of you, showed up to bring attention in a peaceful manner, to lift up those lives lost, and to bring attention to that, to people, right? Elected officials who could potentially do something about it. You know, they could use their voice. They could try to, you know, enact something using their ability and their power to do so. But this was met with some very ugly, with a very ugly response from DC police. And I don't know specifically what, you know, was it MPD, was it Capitol Police? And you all can talk about that. But what happened, right? What did you all see? As I read in the press release, people were being choked, you know, with their own keffiyehs, their scarves,
You know, obviously, as Evan just kind of alluded to, pushed around, having their glasses, Evan had his glasses knocked out. But talk to us, you know, what happened? What did you all see and experience that day?
So for me, I was holding a sign. It was part of, you know, a larger sign that said the whole world is watching. And, you know, almost immediately after we set up, we didn't even finish setting up the 10,000 candles, like Evan said. Capitol Police kind of stormed the group of people. And the first thing that I saw was, you know, dozens and dozens of Capitol Police officers with their bikes. And they used their bikes to shove us off the steps of the building. And, you know, so I was first hit with a bike, and then they established, they grabbed barricades and were using barricades to push the crowd back. And, you know, if you've ever been at the DNC building, there's a parking lot right in front of it. So we were in between the building and the parking lot, and there's a fence there. So we were being pushed by bikes and by barricades and being squeezed against this fence by the police. They did not give any, they didn't give dispersal orders. They didn't give warnings. You know, I remember one of the first things I started yelling was, we have a police liaison. We have a police liaison. Please talk to them. We didn't get that. We just got brute force. So as we were being pushed, and squeezed between the barricades and the fence, there were two older women who were close to me and who were pepper sprayed and were panicking. I grabbed one of them and found a medic, took them to the medic. And as I went back into the crowd to find the other one, I was hit again with the barricade. I had bruises all over my knee, and I was pepper sprayed. So I was trying to help somebody who was also being pepper sprayed. And, you know, I just collapsed on the ground and waited for the medic to come find us both. And honestly, it was terrifying. It was very scary. And, you know, I have seen police react in this way in, you know, 2020 against BLM protesters. I know that the police act this way, but it's another thing entirely to feel it for yourself. You know, it triggered some strong PTSD in me, and it was honestly terrifying knowing that, you know, my friends were not safe in that moment. And we were trying to get people to safety, trying to get people to medics, trying to move out of the way. But, you know, we were being squeezed by barricades and a fence, and we were being pepper sprayed, and there was nowhere to go. We had police on both sides of the street. We didn't know where we could safely exit. It was truly a very chaotic and traumatizing seen from what I witnessed.
Thank you, Vic, and sorry you had to go through that. Faye?
Yeah, I'm happy to just add on to what Vic has already mentioned, because I think, Vic, you hit a lot of the main points. I know I was part of the march that arrived at the DNC, and once the march arrived, it was very interesting to see how the police were very quick. And to your actual question, Daniel, it was both MPD and Capitol Police. Mm-hmm. So it was the Special Operations Division as well as Capitol Police working together to suppress this protest. And it was interesting because they, you know, arbitrarily started drawing lines, right? So there's all of a sudden a bike line in front of us. There's people pushing me with bikes, right? I'm getting shoved. I had bruises on my legs from the bikes hitting me, and from my refusal to just like move arbitrarily to a place where I saw everyone getting squished into. It's like you're pushing me back to a place where I cannot breathe. That doesn't make any sense. There were also lines on either side of the block, as well as the building in front of us and the parking lot behind us. And so we were stuck, right? And for anybody who does not know, that is considered a kettle, right? Kettling is when police cover a protest on all sides, which is not legal in DC. And so, you know, it is imperative to have a way to leave the protests. It is also imperative for that way to be made clear to all of the people who are involved in the protests, and for there to be clear signals, right? Being told that you're in violation of the law, being told that this is your first warning to vacate the premises, this is your second warning to vacate the premises. Protesters at this action received none of the above, right? We received mace to the face. We received bikes being shoved at our bare bodies. We saw people being thrown downstairs. Two officers, I'll never forget, there was a Black woman, beautiful Afro, singing on the steps, and one officer grabs her by her arms and head, shoulder area, and the other grabs her by her legs, and they fully throw her down the stairs. And they did the same with multiple other people, right? Just unseen, I mean, not unseen, right? But unseen by the general public, there is so much violence to the point where people were jumping the fence behind us to get away, right? There was so much mace in the air that people couldn't breathe and were jumping the fence and running into the parking lot for some reprieve. That is the kind of violence that they were ensuing upon us, the kind of violence that, like, really, as Vic was bringing up, can cause PTSD, can re-trigger PTSD if you already have some symptoms of PTSD. There were folks there with mobility aids who could not leave, who could not move in the ways that the police were instructing them to. There were people with kids, with children, as mace is being deployed, as people are being shoved around with bikes. And so if anybody listening wants to see more of the footage from that night, there is an incredible local videographer named Chuck Modi, who covered a lot from that night, who covered a lot of, like, first person perspectives of protesters, also covered a lot of the advancements by police and the brutality by police. And so definitely check out Chuck Modi on Twitter, Instagram to see some more footage.
Thank you, Faye. And is Modi, M-O-D-Y, M-O-D-I-E?
M-O-D-I.
M-O-D-I. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Evan, anything to add to what you saw, experienced that night?
Absolutely. So I was actually in a little bit of a different location. Again, the idea behind this rally was that as people, as they wrapped up their dinner, would exit and kind of be funneled towards the crowds and be able to see us and hear us and see our messages of peace and wishes for a ceasefire and Palestinian liberation. A lot of us as Democratic voters, right, as the people who put these people in power, as their base, opening up their eyes to what a lot have intentionally closed them to. And so I was stationed kind of back by their other building, where a lot of us were just holding hands and singing ceasefire now, wearing shirts that said ceasefire now and a sign as well. And we were kind of the last section of people to be met with police confrontation because we were further, we weren't at the stairs of the DNC, the steps that Faye described people being flung down. That's the area where people were being tear gassed and were being pepper sprayed at point blank, right? Not just from a few feet, but from inches from someone's face, from their eyes, officers deploying pepper spray right into their face, which is a brutal chemical irritant. Being choked by their own kafias and also being sexually assaulted, right? There's cases of these officers grabbing protesters by their breasts and slamming them to the ground. So we were kind of, I was in this other area kind of lining the sidewalk on another side before we also were kettled by that fence by the parking lot. And we were singing, we were hearing bangs, we were hearing some screams. We had a feeling that this was getting ugly. But again, unlike what is protocol, unlike what I've experienced and what other experienced at every kind of action, where people talk to the police liaison, where the police give warnings of arrest, right? Their first warning, their second warning, and third warning arrests. That happens if it's a die-in in DC. That happens if it is people blocking entrances and exits, kind of regardless of the exculatory steps. That's like the protocol that DC police typically follow and are certainly instructed to follow. So not only were there no risks or warnings of arrest, there weren't even any dispersal warnings, as Faye and Vic both mentioned. So it went 0 to 100, all of a sudden, kind of from down a driveway that had turned a corner. It was this line of U.S. Capitol Police fully in riot gear, decked out, and they just stood there, faced us off, and then silently decided to charge us. And so they ran into us. They were bashing us pretty bad over the heads, parts of our body, pushing us back, but also not giving us any warning or asking for us to move back, just surging forward. So we were falling over. I honestly, when I reflect on what I saw and what happened, I do believe, not that, you know, we were lucky to have this experience, but in terms of people laying on the ground, being pushed to the ground, and the comp stomping, I think we did, you know, it could have been a boot coming down a couple inches and that could have been someone's neck, someone's face. I was pretty badly bruised up. My short shirt was shredded in the shoulder. A lot of other people's shirts got shredded too. Many members of this group suffered from concussions, and not to mention the PTSD and the trauma and just bruises and cuts that so many have experienced. I was pushed over 3 times on the ground. People were clawing to help me up. I was clawing to help others up as they got pushed over ahead of me, taking shields to the heads. As I mentioned earlier, they bashed my glasses off my face, and I really do need those to see. So that was a challenging next few days waiting on the repair to come through and get a new pair myself. And yeah, I was pushed over a bike. And then we too were kettled against this fence in the parking lot, which is very interesting because if the idea was you wanted us to leave, you can ask us to leave, right? If the idea is to clear the area, you can tell us where to go, where to stand if you don't like where we're standing. But I think it's pretty hard to make that argument that that is what the police here, again, the DC Metropolitan Police and the US Capitol Police were trying to do, because they didn't want us out. They wanted to beat us up. And you know, you can get us out, you can disperse the crowd, or you can brutalize us and push up us against the fence and make it impossible for us to leave. And that's what they chose to do. They chose to meet this peaceful crowd, this intergenerational crowd. We were old people, children, multi-ethnic, multi-face crowd, who were singing and praying for peace with their beautiful candles. And they decided to stomp on those candles, and they decided to stomp on us, and make a point. One of the officers of the U.S. Capitol Police that I witnessed, and there's also video footage of this, was screaming at us, at this crowd, was, if I might use an expletive, I can also not, I'll take a nod from you, Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, if you could sanitize it for the radio.
Okay, but it was, I will F you up out here, screaming that at us, a police officer. All sorts of brutal words were being hurled at them from us, in addition to the brutal violence that we've all talked about. And also, it is pretty clear to anyone who saw that, hearing the testimonies of other peaceful protesters, that those in ceasefire now shirts, those with the ceasefire messaging, those wearing keffiyehs were the ones who were targeted. So it was not just as much, hey, we're going to beat up this crowd, but it was specifically zoning in on our messaging. And it's that silencing of speech, that retaliation, that is insult to injury here, and is an extra layer of offense and, quite frankly, just blatant, disgusting behaviors that all the officers here, all the supervising officers chose to execute that day when they could have handled this the way that they handled you know, many other protests, many other pro-Palestinian protests that I've been a part of. This was clearly an exception. And, you know, it's interesting. It's like these peaceful protesters are met in this fashion when the January 6th rioters weren't. And what does that say about, you know, the DC police's agenda and how they view us? And do they even know what a threat is? All very pertinent questions that I hope can be answered.
That's right. No, thank you all for sharing that and fully realizing that it does bring up memories and can trigger, you know, a lot of things for you all. So thank you for sharing that and with our audience. Evan, you use the, you know, the word, you said chose, right? They chose to act this way. And to me, that's what really kind of sticks out, right? Like they made a choice, right? They said, we are going to meet these peaceful protesters by the accounts you all are, have shared with us. They chose to go above and beyond in their response, it seems, to what you all were doing. You all were, you know, using your First Amendment rights for all intents and purposes to raise up what was happening, you know, especially once again to these decision makers. But the DC police chose, you know, potentially instructed to have this response that is just not equal to what was happening. As you mentioned, there are have been other protests that, you know, protests happen every day, just about here in the district especially, and we don't see this type of response. You know, what we, especially from, you know, the January 6th, what we saw was a very light response, right, to those people who were actually engaging in violence and causing havoc here in the district, in the district streets, and in our governmental buildings. So talk to us a little bit about that. And that's why I thought it was really important to have you all on, because they made a choice. They made a decision to say, wait a sec, we, you know, could potentially be, as you all have mentioned, around the actual issue. We don't like what you guys are protesting or that you are protesting this. And we are going to send a clear message that you shouldn't be doing this. And we're going to impede on, you know, the rights that you have as, you know, quote unquote, Americans to protest, to raise up your voice and to have diverging, you know, thoughts and messages from the government. So talk to us a little bit about that. Like, how was it just knowing and what does that mean? You know, for protest in general.
I'm happy to jump in there. I think there's a few pieces here. We know historically that this isn't new, right? We know that the repression of our movements is actually historically imperative to the government to maintain its power, right? We've seen this with the intended fall of the Black Panther Party, the same with the Black Liberation Army, different movements for Black liberation. We've seen the same with movements for Arab liberation as well. Some of the major charities that were helping within the United States borders were shut down and violently repressed. We've had countless people taken as political prisoners since this country's inception, right? So, you know, it is not that any of these things are new. I think they are becoming increasingly glaring, right? And I think as they become increasingly glaring, it's imperative for us to not look away.
That's right.
We have to look directly into what we are being shown. And what we're being shown is that at the end of the day, the goal of our government is actually not to represent us, right? Because if it were, right, then the Democrats, at that point, there were 56% of Democrats who wanted a ceasefire, right? And, you know, there are also countless of us who are working for an end to the occupation, but a ceasefire is the floor. And that was in November. It's now been almost a year of ongoing genocide, of brutal attacks, of countless incursions, more and more sieges into Gaza, as well as the West Bank. We're seeing Jenin being flattened now to make the way for more settlements, right? a clear breach of international law. And so, like, we see the government's actions, right? It's imperative for us to not look away. It's imperative for us to not give into apathy and instead to act. And they will continue to brutalize us. They will continue to show up in force in riot gear. They will deploy their tear gas. They will send off their flashbangs. They will make the works out of us. But at the end of the day, we know that our fight is righteous. We know that at the end of the day, we are not the people having bombs dropped over our heads. At least not in this moment, right? We are not the primary experience of violence. And therefore, like, we don't have the ability to look away or to give in. We have to keep fighting. And the police department also has to be held accountable, right? We have to make it to where our First Amendment right to protest is actually being observed, to where our, as you said, quote unquote rights as quote unquote Americans, we are actually allowed to display our dissent towards the actions of our government that we are funding, because we as taxpayers are the ones who are funding the bombs that are being dropped on Palestinians' homes, on their land, on their children. And therefore, we have stake and we have to keep fighting.
That's right. No, thank you for that, Faye. And then thank you for, you know, underscoring that this is, you know, it is nothing new, right? It's shocking every time it happens, but it is the history of this country. So thank you for underscoring that and sharing that. Vic, I think you have something to add.
Yeah, I just, you know, Faye is absolutely right. And, you know, I think there's two things I want to add. One is, we know that the violence that we experienced from the police on that day is minuscule in comparison to the violence that Palestinians are experiencing every single day and have experienced since the beginning of the occupation in 48. And we, at the same time, know that as protesters, we are protected by the First Amendment and should be able to express our political views, express our political dissent to our decision makers that we have access to. So, you know, it's not a surprise that, you know, our police forces train in Israel and are trained by the IDF, and then inflict violence upon us for protecting, for wanting Palestinian liberation, for wanting a ceasefire, for wanting, you know, like Faye said, a full end to the occupation. And, you know, given the fact that we do feel the police have violated our First Amendment rights, you know, there are a group of protesters that are suing MPD and Capitol Police over these civil rights violations. Faye, Evan, and I are not a part of that lawsuit, and we certainly do not speak for the people involved in that lawsuit. But I do want to uplift the fact that our comrades are suing MPD, Capitol Police, and Jason Bagshaw specifically, an MPD commander, who I know Faye might be able to talk more about. But I think it's important that, you know, the reason we have rights as protesters in DC, like Faye was saying, the right for police to give us dispersal orders, the right to not be kettled. The reason we have those rights in DC is because protesters have sued the police before, and we will continue to do whatever we can to make sure that those rights are protected for us and, you know, future protests.
Thank you for that. And yeah, I wanted to make sure, because there's a couple things
We've got not a whole lot of time left, but I want to remind folks that you are tuned into Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. I'm joined this afternoon by Faye, Vic, and Evan, who were all part and unfortunately experienced some horrible brutality from D.C. police, U.S. Capitol Police, in response to their peaceful protest that they were holding in front of the DNC headquarters here in the district. As a result, Vic, you mentioned that there are folks who are taking legal action to say, you know, this just was not right. And, you know, these police officers and the individuals, but, you know, as a force, should not be doing this and should be held accountable for these actions. I think this, you know, sends a larger message to those in power. I want to talk a little bit as well about what maybe the local government response has been. But if Faye, it sounds like you may know a little bit more, Faye, Evan, you know, whoever has a little more information or could speak to this lawsuit, I think it's important for folks to know what's happening with that.
Yeah, well, I can't speak too much to the lawsuit because, as Vic said, none of us are on the lawsuit. However, there are some of our comrades who are also present at the action that night this past November, almost a year ago, who are suing MPD and Capitol Police for their active violence and brutality against protesters who were simply calling for a ceasefire and displaying dissent in front of the Democratic National Committee. One of the officers being listed is the commander of the Special Operations Division unit, Jason Bagshaw, who actually has a well-decorated history of violence against protesters, so much so that he even received his own article from the Fraternal Order of Police. You can look it up, with them glorifying the ways that he is able to suppress dissent. This is somebody who was a lieutenant in the force for many years, and throughout 2020, continued to climb the ranks by his shows of force and his ability to disperse crowds by any means necessary. And so, like, a lot of this violence has also been seen by the DC community before, right? And a lot of it has been because of this officer who holds power in this unit. He also, off duty, eating dinner at the wharf, killed a Black man, Lazarus David Wilson. I think it's important to raise him up in this conversation, who's 21 years old. And he was shot and killed by Jason Bagshaw while he was off duty. And he was promoted, and he's now commander of the Special Operations Division. And so this is somebody who not only has demonstrated a long history of violence against protesters and against Black communities in DC, but also has only been promoted and given more power as he's displayed this violence and brutality, right? So when you're being given positive affirmation for the actions that you're committing against the people of DC, you're going to continue to commit them. And so the violence this past November is a natural result of that. This is a person who has way too much power, not only in the force, but in DC. And him being named in this case is also not the first time. He was also one of the officers involved in a prior case when Black Lives Matter Plaza, during 2020, I believe June, the first or second week of June, I can't remember the exact date, but set off dozens of tear gas canisters on peaceful protesters so that Trump could take a photo op in front of the church across the street. And violently assaulted multiple protesters, setting off rubber bullets, pepper bullets. Unfathomable violence until you realize that, again, this is rooted in a history of police violence that has also occurred in 2014. That also has occurred countless other times in our history of choosing to fight back and tell our government what we believe, what we see as right, and then showing us over and over again that they're not willing to act differently. They're not willing to act within our interests. And so this lawsuit that is being brought is really important to not only limit MPD's and Capitol Police's police power over protests, but also to demonstrate the will of the people that right now calls for a free Palestine, that right now calls for an end to the occupation and an end to the apartheid.
Thank you for that. Evan, anything to add?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, I, moved to DC and started organizing this fall, this October, in the wake of the October 7th attacks and demanding a ceasefire back then. And one of the first lessons I learned was about Jason Bagshaw. I was marshaling another march with another organizer, a Black woman who had been taking action and calling him out in her organization around, him murdering. And he immediately identified her in the crowd, came up, was loitering in her face, kind of taunting the fact that he still has power, his power over her body. And, she was asking him very respectfully to get out of her personal space, to leave her alone. And he just would not do that. So when I saw him that night in his white shirt, as the people of his status in the U.S. Capitol Police wear, a lot of things made sense. That was one of the first lessons I learned in D.C. was kind of, hey, be wary of this guy. And there he was, being the authoritarian figure with the authority to conduct his forces over us in this way. And I think what this lawsuit does that's so important is that it makes sure that they don't get away with it. It seems like the mentality was that of complete impunity and immunity that night. A lot of the officers were acting in a way as if they had received permission to be as brutal as they were, so blatantly and out in the open this time. And the only reason that we have this policy that's typically used by the DC police and Capitol Police of giving three warnings for arrest is because they've been sued so many times over that this is what they institute. So the question is, why did this lapse, right? And it does seem to be there was some permission given by those inside the building, by these high-ranking Democrats, to clear us out, kind of no matter the cost. They were tired of us, tired of the optics, and they wanted to make the problem go away, and they chose to use force to do this. So what this lawsuit is doing is saying, you cannot use this as an option. You cannot get away with this. It's holding them to account. It is hopefully making it very costly for them to operate in this way. And it is also setting the record straight in what happened. And this is one point that I want to highlight here. Because in the wake of this, there was tweets sent out by the Capitol Police conflating this peaceful assembly to January 6th, saying lesson learned and justifying their response to us. There was a statement put out by Hakeem Jeffries and Catherine Clark, the number one and number two Democrats, thanking the professionalism. This is a direct quote. We are thankful for the service and professionalism of U.S. Capitol Police officers who worked to ensure the members, staff, and visitors were able to safely exit. And then I'm continuing on saying that in their joint statement that this protest exceeded a peaceful protest, which it clearly did not, and all the violence was lost by the police. And also, most dearteningly for me, in terms of the rhetoric that was used by the Democratic establishment and the police in the wake of this protest was when it was actually codified by law and legislation that was passed, not just brought to the floor, but passed by the U.S. House of Representatives, H.R. 894, where it cites this protest specifically in a long laundry list of incidences across the world. And it cites this protest on November 15th, saying that anti-Israel protesters illegally blocked and violently attacked the Democratic National Committee headquarters, endangering the lives of individuals inside, including members of Congress, which is clearly and blatantly not true, right? All the footage backs that up. It's very clear that's not at all what happened. And it used this pretense, this clause, for the House to pass and codify in law a direct quote that, quote, clearly and firmly states that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, end quote. So that's what the House did as a result and used this protest as pretense for that, when we know that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. And that's a very dangerous thing to do, as it conflates any critique of the state of Israel or Israel's actions, i.e. the genocide that they are carrying out right now, as anti-Semitic, which is blatantly false. And another horrible, horrible action to come from these legislators post this peaceful demonstration. And so this lawsuit can hopefully codify in law too the misbehavior of the police and correct that record.
Thank you for that, Evan. And we've only got a few minutes left, but I want to make sure that folks who want to follow this, the case is Rise et al. Versus Bagshaw et al. It's filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Any closing thoughts, any way that folks can support? And I apologize, we're running short on time. We got about 3 minutes, any closing thoughts from each of you? Faye, I see you have something.
Yeah, I'll try to make this as brief as possible. I just really want to also question, what do we think of when we think of peaceful, right? The MPD department said on record, we've seen many peaceful protests and this wasn't one, right? And I think what we need to do in this moment is really question what we've been taught as peaceful, and what is peaceful about arms transfers? What is peaceful about US bombs on Palestinian grounds? What is peaceful about blocking the ICJ's investigations into Israel? What is peaceful about blocking a ceasefire resolution? There are currently over 200 proposed bills federally federally and locally to repress current movements, including random legislation such as sending students to Gaza, right? In recompense for student encampments. And so as we continue seeing this to crack down, we have to continue fighting back, and we have to keep making sure that our voices are being heard. Make sure to follow the case, make sure to boost the petition, because there is an accompanying petition as well.
Thank you so much, Faye. Vic and Evan, any last brief words, please?
If folks who are listening, are feeling moved to get involved, there is a vigil this upcoming Monday, 4:30 at the White House, being organized by disability rights activists, honoring the martyrs of Gaza and the ongoing mass disabling act that is this genocide. There are actions happening every single week that support Palestinian liberation and fight this ongoing genocide. So just get involved. There are so many ways to be a part of this fight for Palestinian liberation.
Thank you, Vic. And Evan, anything to leave us with in about 30 seconds?
Absolutely. I want to uplift everything that Faye and Vic has said as well. And I think with Faye's framing about what's peaceful and what's violent, just encouraging all listeners to seize our agency and to keep pressing forward and look at the war on Black and brown people in this country, in Palestine, and do what we can to turn the tap off on violence from state powers and otherwise, and keep organizing, keep fighting undeterred to end the war on Palestine and end the war on Black and brown bodies.
Thank you all so much. Once again, I want to thank you for your time and for, but once again, kind of reliving, rehashing, these horrible events that you all experience, as well as others. We want to make sure that folks heard what happened, follow the case, because as you heard, it ripples. It seeks to limit our expression. It stomps on our rights. So once again, thank you all so much. Hopefully we can have a show in the future when as the lawsuit moves through and the result of it.
But once again, thank you all so much. Stay tuned, folks. You've got COVID, Race, and Democracy in just a couple of minutes. But before that, the news. Peace, everyone. We will catch you next Tuesday.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The far-right German AfD party won a regional election in eastern Germany on Sunday and finished in a close second in another. The AfD victory in Thuringia marked the first far-right state election win in Germany since the end of World War II. The governing coalition, led by center-left Olaf Scholz, performed poorly, trailing both the AfD and the mainstream opposition center-right Christian Democratic Party. The AfD has fomented anti-immigrant sentiment, which is stronger in eastern Germany than in the West, and has capitalized on inflation and a weak economy. Eastern Germany is less economically developed than the West, due largely to decades of Cold War divergence. Scholz's coalition and the other mainstream parties have rejected working with the AfD as it has grown in recent years. And Scholz on Sunday called on parties to, quote, form stable governments without far-right extremists. Federal elections will be held in Germany in a little over a year. A Venezuelan judge yesterday ordered the arrest of opposition presidential candidate Edmundo González as part of a criminal investigation into the results of a July election. Both the opposition and the ruling party, led by President Nicolas Maduro, claimed to have won the July election, triggering a political crisis and international pressure to release detailed results. The arrest warrant comes after authorities accused González of crimes including conspiracy and falsifying documents. González has not appeared in public since the day after the election. Thousands of anti-government protesters were arrested in the days after the election. Vote tally sheets collected by the opposition and published online showed González winning significantly more votes than reported by Maduro's government. An attempted jailbreak in the Congolese capital Kinshasa early yesterday left at least 129 people killed, some from gunshots and others from a stampede at the prison. Activists say the true death toll is higher. Congo's interior minister said 24 inmates were fatally killed by, quote, warning shots fired by guards. Amnesty International says the prison holds over 12,000 inmates, most of whom are awaiting trial, but has a capacity for only 1,500 people. Rights groups and opposition political figures accused the government of using excessive force and covering up deaths. Congo's justice minister blamed lower-level judges for prison overcrowding and announced an effort to build a new prison. In domestic news, outgoing President Biden held a Labor Day campaign rally with Democratic Party nominee Kamala Harris in Pennsylvania, where Harris backed Biden's month-long opposition to a proposed purchase of U.S. Steel by a Japanese steel company.
U.S. Steel is an historic American company, and it is vital for our nation to maintain strong American steel companies. And I couldn't agree more with President Biden. U.S. Steel should remain American-owned and American-operated. And I will always have the back of America's steelworkers.
Harris also used her appearance to extol the virtues of labor unions, a key constituency in swing states, including Pennsylvania. Biden has said since March that selling U.S. steel to Japanese Nippon Steel would hurt American workers, a position also embraced by GOP nominee Donald Trump. Earlier yesterday, Harris attended a Labor Day parade across the state in Pittsburgh with Biden after flying in from an event in Detroit. And thousands of hotel workers are on strike for a third straight day in dozens of cities nationwide. The walkout includes more than 10,000 Hilton, Marriott, and Hyatt employees who say they want higher pay, better working conditions, and more staff. Unite Here, the union representing hotel employees, is asking for a reversal of cuts to staffing and guest services that many hotels made during the